Film Nerds Unlimited. Lo-fi movie conversations with high-quality movie connoisseurs.
Issue 139.
Ben Stark of Wondermill Films.
Jeremy Burgess of Rough Riders.
I'm here with Jeremy Burgess. Jeremy, how are you?
I'm great, Ben. How are you?
Very good. So, well, kind of good. I'm recovering from this week's Sidewalk Film Festival in Birmingham, Alabama, which is always a blast.
Man.
Yeah, it's always a blast, but it's always exhausting, and I didn't even experience very much of it, and it still wiped me out. So, we thought we would talk a little bit about some of the movies we saw and some of the movies we wished we had seen at this year's film festival. So I guess the best way to start is, why don't you go through your top five films that you did see? I'll talk about the few that I managed to see, and then maybe we can talk about some of the things we missed. Is that cool with you?
Sure. You want me to rattle off all five of mine now, or kind of alternate?
Yeah. Well, just start with the first one, and if I might ask you some questions. Or go 5-1. 5-1. This is a countdown.
Cool. Well, feel free to interject. So, I did manage to see roughly 10, well, exactly 10 movies this weekend. So, the better half of that 10, we'll start with one called Kate Plays Christine, which was not perfect. It was maybe a little too long, and the second act did drag a little bit, but it's certainly something that I had never seen before. It is a hybrid documentary narrative feature of sorts. The focus is on the true story of a woman named Christine Chubbuck, who is a Florida news reporter that committed suicide on air. But it's not a documentary about her life. Rather, it's a documentary about actress Caitlin Shields, who is researching the role of Christine Chubbuck to play her in a movie that might not even exist. So it's really a fascinating look at the process of an actor and how hard it is sometimes when, for one thing, you don't know too much about who you're playing, because a lot of this footage of Christine Chubbuck is locked in a vault somewhere, but also what it's like to play a really dark and depressing role, and how much of that depression and darkness you have to invite into your own life to kind of get it right. So this played at Sundance alongside another film called Christine, which is about a narrative version of the same story. So somehow we got two Christine Chubbuck movies in one year, and I think they're both getting pretty good praise. So that was number five for me.
So that's like a deep impact Armageddon situation.
Oh, totally.
But not quite as fun. So I have a question. So you said it was
kind of a
documentary slash narrative hybrid. So you're saying the narrative portion of it is this potentially fictional movie that she's preparing for?
Yeah, you start getting a lot of those clips toward the middle and the end of the film. And it'll just be clips from this movie. And I checked IMDb. I don't see an actual, like, narrative feature credited to Caitlin Shields' list. So I don't know if this movie was just part of the device or if it's actually going to come out. The last 10 minutes or so is mostly scenes from the penultimate scene of the film and how Kate is struggling to play that a little bit and what she does with that material. So yeah, it's really fascinating. It does go back and forth, but it's mostly a documentary.
That's fascinating. Okay, cool.
Yeah, so number four for me is a tried and true documentary that's a little bit by the book, but also a fascinating story nonetheless. It's called Author, the J.T. Leroy story. And I don't know if you're familiar with the saga of J.T. Leroy. I was not. But
no.
It is the story of one of the bigger scams of the 90s and early 2000s. It's about an author who pretends to be this other person named J.T. Leroy, who was the son of a lot lizard, basically, turning tricks at truck stops and whatnot. So wrote these two books under the pseudonym of J.T. Leroy, and then hired her sister-in-law to actually go out in public as J.T. Leroy. And for years, they did this, where this person would go to all kinds of literary festivals and then places like Cannes, and would just be hanging out with all these crazy celebrities like Billy Corgan and Gus Van Sant, pretending to be someone named J.T. Leroy. And so it was fascinating how they pulled this whole thing off. And they go behind the scenes, tell you really exactly everything that went on to make this whole ruse work, really. And it was really interesting. The doc reminded me a little bit of Cobain Montage of Heck from last year in terms of the style. And, it's a story that I had no idea about, and it's actually pretty recent too, so I was a teenager when all this was going on, had no clue.
Interesting. Yeah. I've never heard of this before, so now I'll have to, I mean, there's no, we don't have any release information on these, do we, in terms of like expectations on if they have distribution or if, I imagine if it played at Sun, this one played Sundance? Or
this one also played Sundance,
yeah.
So I would imagine it'll be VOD by the end of the year.
Sure, okay. Yeah, that's so fascinating.
Yeah, so moving on to number three, this one, I believe you were in the audience for this one as well, called Cheerleader.
Yep.
And so, I'll let you chime in on this too then. I loved it, for one. I thought it was delightful. It's the story of a cheerleader in high school who is basically just trying to survive the high school landscape and also make her ex-boyfriend jealous. So she goes on a date with this nerd, and that's really the bulk of what happens. There's other parts to it as well, of course, but it's the debut feature from a guy named Irving Franco, who I did not know until checking IMDb, but he wrote, directed, produced, composed, and production designed the thing himself. So he seems to be a Renaissance man, and all of those things he did really well. Like, the music is great, the production design is fantastic, and so this is really his baby, I guess, and I think he's quite good at what he's done, and I hope we get to see more from him soon.
Yeah, absolutely. I think delightful is a great word for it. His talent is to a fellow filmmaker quite frustrating, because he can do all of those things well.
I'm maybe good at like one and a half of those things.
Yeah, I'm barely good at any of them.
And he's good at five.
Yeah, it's not fair. It's like you said, it's a delightful movie. It's a plot that I think we've all seen before in terms of, you know, the popular girl, using a nerd to get revenge or something like that on her boyfriend. But he uses that familiar plot to tell a really neat story about identity and about how we assume we know what roles we're filling in society and the groups around us, but it's always up to us to question those roles and to step out of those roles. And so there's a bunch of wonderful little lines and kind of revelations that her character has, because so much of the movie is told through her voiceover. So it's a really nice movie. It looks audacious and interesting, and it has a really great performance from its lead actress. So it was the movie Saturday night, and I'm really happy I was able to make time for it.
Yeah, I did not know who that lead actress was at first. I looked her up, and it looks like she was on Jessica Jones, the TV series.
Okay, so she's definitely on the cusp of something, I think, because she's really good.
Yeah, I think this might be a breakout role for her. I really hope it is.
And any idea where this is going or what's happened with it so far in terms of getting to paying customers?
I think that Cheerleader is actually near the beginning of its festival cycle. A lot of stuff we see at Sidewalk is towards the end. Even some of it's like already on VOD. And so Sidewalk sometimes is like, sometimes feels like a greatest hits of the festival circuit. But this one, the only ones I know of thus far, it's probably played more, but it's played the Florida Film Festival and the Atlanta Film Festival. So, yeah, and one of the programmers said that she got a hold of this movie from one of the Atlanta programmers. So I think she just kind of got a tip, and then we programmed it, and I think it played really well, too.
Nice. Well, yeah, I mean, this weekend they screened Labyrinth, and Space Jam, which are both pretty far at the end of their film festival runs. So
I think Space Jam still has some legs to it.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's playing at the Portland Film Festival next week.
Space Jam's festival trajectory is kind of like Jordan's arm stretched out at the end where he's dunking.
Yeah.
That's like the 20-year festival stretch where people just keep programming Space Jam. It's crazy.
Yeah, it's crazy. All right, so that was your number three. What's your number two?
So number two for me is probably the movie I was most excited about for this weekend, and that was the opening night film, Ty West's In a Valley of Violence. And I am a horror guy. I love horror movies. You know this about me.
Yep.
Ty West is one of the better filmmakers of this millennium, I'd say, in terms of horror. He gave us House of the Devil, and he gave us The Sacrament, and he gave us The Innkeepers, which I didn't love, but the other two, very good. So when I heard last year, I think last fall, that he was doing a Western, I was so thrilled, because I love Westerns as well. So I saw that this one played South by Southwest. I think it premiered there, and obviously I was a little jealous of everybody in Austin that got to see it. And then, of course, when we got it programmed here, I was thrilled once again. And it did not disappoint. I talked to a few people that had mixed reviews on it, but for me, it felt like exactly what I expected from a Ty West Western, I guess. And we've got a much bigger cast in terms of name than he's used to. We've got John Travolta, Ethan Hawke, Tysa Farmiga, Karen Gillian, probably a few I'm missing. But yeah, it felt like a traditional Western with like a nice style to it, kind of a more modern flair to it. And I don't want to give too much away because this one is actually coming out in theaters in October, I believe. But yeah, and Ty West was at the festival himself. He was there all weekend partying with us. So, yeah, I think this was his first time in Birmingham, and I'm glad that he graced us with what I think is his best movie to date. So I think he's got a really bright future ahead of him because, you know, with horror directors, sometimes you don't know what to expect when they jump out of the genre. But for him, it felt natural. Like, the dialogue was great. He's got an eye for the scenery. The sets looked great. I mean, it's, you know, he hit all the marks. There was, I think the only detractor for me is that it kind of became too much of a comedy toward the end. Actually really funny throughout, but the comedy was more like comic relief up until the third act. Then it felt like it kind of leaned on the comedy a bit too much.
Interesting.
But other than that, I mean, I thought it delivered pretty much across the board.
Yeah, he's one of those filmmakers that whenever House of the Devil popped up, I was like, ooh, I should check that out. And then The Innkeepers came out, and I was like, oh, he's got another movie already. I really need to get on his – and then The Sacrament came out, and it's just like I can't keep up with how quickly he's becoming a noted filmmaker. So I just need to – I need to stop what I'm doing someday and actually go check out one of his movies. And I'm it kills me that I wasn't able to make it down on Friday night for this one, but sounds like I'll get plenty of chances to see it in the future.
Yeah, and I think those first three of his are all on Netflix as well, or at least House of the Devil was. I'm pretty sure The Sacrament still is.
Perfect.
Great. So number one for me from Sidewalk this weekend, a little bit of bias going into it. I'll say first off, it's called Little Sister. It was the closing night film. It was produced by a Birmingham local and friend of mine, Melody Fisk, who's produced a number of films over the years that have played all sorts of big festivals like Tribeca and South by Southwest, which is actually where this one premiered back in March. And it is the fourth film by director Zach Clark, who I've only seen one thing from him before, and that was White Reindeer, which played at Sidewalk 2 years ago. I thought that was fine. Maybe not my cup of tea, but I could see the merit in it. And so with Little Sister, I didn't quite know what to expect. And I was blown away. It was, it's the story of a young nun who's in her early 20s living in New York, and she gets an email from her mother that her brother is returned home. We find out that her brother is an Iraq war vet. This takes place in 2008, I believe, leading up to the election, and that's mentioned a little bit throughout the film. So she returns home to try and welcome her brother, even though he kind of doesn't really want to be around anyone for a while. He's got some scars and whatnot from the war. He's got, some physical stuff that he's dealing with. So our main character, Colleen, she's also dealing with her mother, who's a little bit kooky, I guess you'd say. And it felt like it was going to be a crisis of faith movie where we have this nun or this young girl who's about to go through her final confirmation, I guess you'd call it, to become a full sister. And she comes home, and I was kind of like, okay, well, I know where this is going. But it really took me by surprise, and I'll try not to spoil anything.
Please don't.
Sure. But yeah, in the Q&A afterward, Zach Clark said he didn't want to make a Crisis of Faith movie. So I think that what he did with that trope that it felt like it was leaning on was really interesting. And there's just a bunch of lovely, subtle work going on in this movie. Colleen, the lead actress, I forget her name. She's fantastic. Ally Sheedy from Breakfast Club plays the mother as well. But it's a really interesting commentary on how modern Christianity is perceived, or how it could be perceived. And, he said it's not a crisis of faith movie. I think it might be a face of crisis movie, if that makes sense, where it's fine to go out into the world and to experience that world and still hold on to what you believe in. I guess that's
right.
A way to boil it down. So, and it's not a Christian movie by any means at all. There's a scene where she does a sing-along to a Gwar song. So I'm pretty sure anybody that's offended
that's
by such would tune out immediately.
Well, it sounds like a Kirk Cameron scene, the way you're describing it.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah.
But anyway, yeah,
The way you're describing it, the vaguest terms, it kind of reminds me of Ida, that Polish movie from a few years ago. Did you see that?
I did see that, and I was actually thinking of Ida as I was watching it. It does not go the same place Ida does.
Sure.
It's obviously, in terms of form, it's very different. Ida was black and white, hardly any dialogue.
Yeah.
But I think they would make a good double feature for sure, because while both of them ring true, I think, they do different things and maybe have a little bit of a different message to show there.
Interesting. Awesome. Yeah. I mean, based on your recommendation and based on the buzz of Little Sister in general coming out of Sidewalk, it definitely became, it's near the top of my must-see-this list that I've got here. And, and aside from the local connections, I feel like it didn't have a ton of buzz going in. I mean, it had a really nice spot screening on the closing night, but it just didn't seem like one of those, going into the fest, everybody seemed like was more buzzing about in the Valley of Violence,
sure.
Or even Cheerleader. And so I'm happy to hear this really, you know, separated itself from the pack.
Yeah, well, I don't think it got a ton of press except for around South by Southwest when it premiered. And I'm sure it's been a festival between then and now. But one critic I do follow, David Ehrlich, from used to be with Rolling Stone, I believe. And he's sometimes really tough to impress, but he seemed to really like this movie, and I think he called it Goth Kid Garden State. So from his perspective, I think he said, you know, who knew that this sort of movie was necessary, like 10 years after Garden State, but he loved it. So that gave me a lot of encouragement going into it, like, okay, if David really liked this movie, then, you know, I think I'll give it a shot.
Awesome. Well, I'll quickly kind of run through the two that I saw that we haven't talked about. So I saw Cheerleader, and it was very good. I also rewatched Raiders, the story of the Raiders of the Lost Ark adaptation. That was the opening night film at last year's Sidewalk Film Festival.
Yeah.
And it was a lot of fun, and it brought the house down. And this year, it was playing like right as my wife and I were getting into town, but I was like, I really think we need to see this movie because, again, as a filmmaker and as a married filmmaker now with a child, I feel like it's such an invigorating movie for couples, basically, that are either making films together or one spouse is in
Definitely.
The corner of the other while they're making the movie, because it just depicts it's not much of the movie, I don't think, really, but it just depicts this really healthy relationship of Eric Zala and his wife Cassie,
mm-hmm.
and the way that she stands behind him and stands with him and doesn't, you know, she's not just like blindly letting him do whatever he wants, but she's also not, she says in the movie, she doesn't want to be the spouse that stands in the way of him living out one of his dreams. So it's a really sweet, fun movie, and I believe it's finally getting distribution, maybe. I know they're on like a national tour and a tour bus right now, and that's kind of how it functioned this weekend as an encore screening. We were part of their stop.
And paired with the actual adaptation.
Exactly,
too, right?
Paired with the adaptation, which we didn't stick around for because I actually saw that like on a like VCD that a friend of mine gave me.
Have you seen it?
In like 2003. Yeah. It's
oh,
a
you
lot
saw
less.
the wow, okay.
Yeah, it was like 2003 or 2004 when he gave me this VCD that he had burned from, he'd found it on like Bear Share or something like that.
Of course.
And yeah, of course. And it was it's you know, it's super charming, but I'm sure it played a lot better in a room full of movie fans than it did, you know, just me by myself on,
sure.
you know, my PC, whenever that happened. But yeah, it's, the whole story is great. And, I've loved keeping up with the ongoing kind of fallout of everything. And, I was so happy that they were able to bring it back. And then the other movie I saw was Service to Man, which is kind of a movie about the first Jewish student at an all-black medical school in Tennessee in 1967. So it obviously race is a major theme of this film, but it comes at it from an interesting standpoint where you have two marginalized races having to deal with one another and deal with the racism that they're all kind of, you know, naturally dealt and having to deal with. So it's got a bunch of really good performances. Full disclosure, it was co-directed by my old film professor from Alabama, Aaron Greer, whose 2004 movie, Getting Grown, is also really good. I like Service to Man a lot. It's written and co-directed by Seth Penich, who's a theater professor at the University of Alabama, and it's actually based on the experience that his father had in medical school at that college. I don't want to guess the name of the college because I did forget what it was, but it's really fun. It's for such a heavy subject matter, that being a racially charged drama, about medical school. It's got a ton of levity and a ton of laugh-out-loud scenes. There's one particularly memorable scene where medical students have to help a woman give birth, and it's great. It's and there's just a bunch of really great young actors in it that that I think are going to be popping up all over the place pretty soon. So that's a Service to Man. This was, I believe, the premiere of the movie. It's right at the start. I'm not sure where it's going to go. I feel like it would have a huge success as a family film, but there are a number of F-bombs in the movie, so that probably won't happen. I think it'll definitely find a lot of traction because it won the Audience Award this weekend. And it was screened at on Sunday morning at 10 o'clock, and it was a packed house, and it got an Audience Award. So that's not necessarily a super favorable screening time. So for it to get that reaction, I feel like it's really struck a chord with people.
For sure. I did want to see that one. I was actually across town at the Red Mountain Theater Company for another feature by an Alabama director, which was Curse of the Man Who Sees UFOs. I'll give that a quick shout out. Justin Garr, who I believe you know as well.
Right. He was also one of Aaron's students and a coworker of mine.
Yeah. And so this was his debut feature film. It was a documentary about a man in California who has kind of staked his life's reputation on UFO sightings. So it was really, really interesting character-based doc. I liked it a lot. I think Justin's got a good future ahead of him.
Yeah, and I mean, I would be it would be silly for me not to mention that that Greer was also also taught Graham and Ben Flanagan, fellow film nerds, and the Flanagans are also good friends with Justin. So, the Sidewalk is always a great place to reconnect with people from our past and people that we've worked with in the past, and I don't want to say it's a relief, but it's always. It's always great to see, the people that you know that also be extremely talented so that you don't have to feel, cheap when you say that their movies are good because these are all strong filmmakers. And I wish I had seen Curse of the Man Who Sees UFOs, but as you said, it was screening at the same time as Service to Man. There are a few other, before we get into our kind of proper misses list, there's also a few other films by friends of ours that I was hoping to check out, including the New Orleans Sazerac by James Martin. I did get a free drink from their table, but didn't see their movie, and I feel horrible about that. Did you manage to see that one?
I hope Jen and James aren't listening. I still haven't seen it. I think this was actually my first opportunity at a festival setting because they took this thing to Cannes. They've been everywhere.
Yeah, exactly.
And, sometimes it's you feel guilty being that guy hey, man, can you just send me a link and I can watch it on my lunch break? You want to go there and support that.
Right, yeah, you want to be in the audience.
But they did have a Sazerac pop-up that I got to go to and hang out, which is cool. James was just pouring samples of the titular cocktail from the dock, and that was very cool. They did the same thing the next day, too, kind of like a reprise of the pop-up on Sunday afternoon as well.
Yep, that's where I had my drink, and it was great.
There you go.
And then I also missed Stacey Davis's The Sibling Code.
We've actually had the opportunity to see Sibling Code and watch their festival run as it's been going pretty well. They played Oxford, they played Nantucket. I think they got a lot ahead of them too. So they seem to be doing real well with that.
Yep. And then our friend Ian Cunningham also had some movie that we can't pronounce. So we'll just kind of breeze right past that.
It's in Spanish, but we can say he is with his company is Over Fork Over Films, and I do believe that he just put it up on YouTube. So if you go to Facebook, search for Over Fork Over Films, should be able to watch that. And if it's not on YouTube, then my apologies. Just bug Ian about it. He'll probably be flattered.
Yeah, no, it's on YouTube. It's on my to-do list to watch. So let's go quickly through our top five movies that we missed.
Well, one quick shout-out for me, a filmmaker buddy of mine, Ben Rand, had a short this weekend as well, which I actually got to go to the local like cast and crew screening. And so I've seen it a couple times, even though I wasn't in the cast or crew. But this was his festival premiere, and Ben just started film school out in Denver. So he wasn't able to make it back. But, you know, obviously I've worked with him twice in crews before, and he was actually crew on Little Sister as well. So,
okay.
Yeah, so he's got a good future ahead of him for sure.
But what's the name of
the
his
film
movie?
World. His movie is called To Live.
Okay.
That's the number, or sorry, that's not the number. It's the word T-O.
Okay, because I was going to see it. Did not see the first one.
Yeah. That, you mean One Live?
Right, One Live.
Yeah.
Okay, so my number five movie that I wish I had seen, and I will say that this is a combination of movies that were on my list before the festival, and
then
kind of got whittled out here in the last day or so once I kind of saw the buzz. So this is a post-festival wish I had seen, not a pre-festival wish I would see, if that makes any sense. So my number five is Holy Hell by Will Allen. This looks like a fascinating documentary about a Los Angeles cult. Did you see this one? I can't remember if it was on your list.
Yeah, I did see this one, but not this weekend. I actually saw it in April at the Nashville Film Festival. And, I loved it. I thought it was fantastic. It's a really unique perspective for a doc because, you know, not anybody, but a lot of talented filmmakers could go cut a doc-based or a cult-based documentary from old footage and news clips and whatnot. But Will was in the cult for 22 years, which is crazy. And he was their videographer. So he got, like, it's the most intimate look at a cult that you'll probably ever get unless someone does the same thing he did for 32 years, you know?
Right. Yeah, no, that's the hook of it that really got me, was that this is all, it seems like it's predominantly footage captured during the time that he was in the cold. And yeah, and like you said, it's entirely from the perspective of somebody that was in the midst of it. And it seems like he interviewed a lot of the people that were in it as well. So it really comes at it with the perspective of what were we thinking, which...
Which
if you don't have the perspective of somebody that's come out of it, could potentially be condescending, you know, but I feel like that lends it a measure of mercy that you might not get otherwise. So, it makes it a fascinating look. What's your number five?
Sure. My number five is called The Love Witch, and a lot of my friends got to see this one on Saturday in the evening time. I can't remember where I was. I think it was played right before Cheerleader. But I heard some mixed reviews, but I heard good reviews from all the people I trust, which is, you know, that's how you got to weed those sort of things out. But, our good friend Chance, I think that was his favorite one from the weekend.
Okay, I can
and
see
so
that.
I trust Chance's opinion on that sort of thing. Really, all I know about it is that there's like a retro 60s vibe to it, and there's a character who's a witch, and she makes men fall in love with her. Maybe women too, I'm not sure. But I think it's just kind of chronicling her witchiness, which sounds really cool.
Yeah, and the trailer has a very Dario Argento kind of vibe. Which I'm sure a lot of people like. That was on my list as well. My number four is a short doc by Saul Friedman called Bacon and God's Wrath, which is, I think, a 10-minute short about a 90-year-old Jewish woman who is about to eat bacon for the first time. And it's a premise that is so strong, and it totally, you know, it validates the entire short documentary format, which is... It's just this moment in a real person's life and it's soaked with, it seems like it would be soaked with so much gravity, you know, and but at the same time, it's potentially whimsical. So, yeah, I just feel like if it could have a lot of humanity packed into 10 minutes, and I think, and just the premise alone seems very neat. And I have
very
no
cool,
other information
yeah.
on it, because I never heard of it otherwise, except for on the sidewalk.
I feel like short docs have, like, a unique opportunity. Like, short docs should be way bigger than they are, because it's like extended news clips, you know? Like, these should be, like, very popular, and I don't know. I guess some of them can be, but, yeah, I always like checking out a good doc shorts block whenever I can.
What's your number four?
So, my number four is a documentary called Dead Hands Dig Deep, which is a great title.
It is
and
a great title.
I don't believe that I talked to anyone that saw this over the weekend, which is kind of a bummer, but I know it was a pretty late screening on Saturday night when a lot of people were going to the after party by that time. But this is a documentary that sounds really up my alley, and it was made by a 19-year-old and premiered at Slam Dance, so that alone caught my attention. But then the fact that it's a documentary of the lead singer, I forget his name, he's the lead singer of a really crazy, intense heavy metal band called Kettle Cadaver. And this guy has become like an underground legend because of his stage antics, which include self-mutilation and probably other weird things that are unspeakable. But I for one, heavy metal is maybe only like 15 or 20% of what I listen to normally, but I love it, and I think it translates really well into cinema because there's so many great, crazy stories like this one. And so that's something that I definitely want to check out. And never even heard the band before, but, you know, I'm not sure if one of their live shows is exactly my cup of tea. hey, man, art is weird. And
yeah.
Heavy metal,
I mean,
has a very unique interpretation of art, and I think that's fascinating. So this is
definitely
on my list.
It's a very visual musical genre, you know, in terms of lyrics and even in a way music itself. But the great name for a movie and great title, great name for a band.
Dead Hands Dig Deep.
Awesome. Yeah, my number three, we already talked about it, In a Valley of Violence by Ty West. I will definitely be checking it out soon. And, what's your number three?
Cool. So my number three, I don't know much about, except that people who have already seen it are still kind of confused, and that is The Greasy Strangler.
Right.
Our friend Corey Kraft saw it and just reviewed it on Letterboxd. Didn't give it a score because his one-sentence review said, "How the hell do you give this thing a score?" And Ian actually pointed to another review that gave it 1/2 star and said, "This is the sort of film that you have to either give a perfect score or the lowest possible score because there's really no in between." And so that, of course, I think is fascinating. And now I really want to see it because, you know, what kind of movie necessitates that sort of reaction where it's so polarizing that people are at a loss for words to describe it. It kind of makes me think of Sleepaway Camp. I don't know if you've seen that.
Right. Yes, I haven't, but I am aware of its legend.
Yes. That's the sort of reaction I had watching Sleepaway Camp for the first time last year, where I thought that this movie is awful yet perfect at the same time. And so I'm a big fan of that, and hopefully maybe there's a little bit of that in Greasy Strangler.
Yeah, and it's kind of sad in a way because it sounds like the kind of movie that is perfect for a film festival, you know, where everybody is a little bit tired, a little bit, and nobody's really certain of exactly what they're walking into in any given movie. And it was a late night screening.
Yeah,
so,
that's why I missed it.
Yeah, so you get in there with a bunch of people that are as confused and prone to strange reactions as you are, and then you experience it all together, and I'm sure the conversations about that movie after were as entertaining as the movie itself in some cases.
Yeah, and I want to be part of that conversation now because I'm very fascinated.
My number two is another movie we talked about, Zach Clark's Little Sister.
Great.
Can't wait to see it. I'm sure I will get plenty of chances to see it.
Very cool. So my number two is the only one of two documentaries on my list, I guess. It's called Phil Johnson, Any Way the Wind Blows. And I think a couple of friends of mine saw it. I know my mother did, actually. She liked it a lot. And this one premiered, I think, at the Chicago Film Festival. And it's the story of an old soul singer named Phil Johnson, who was kind of overlooked, even though he was really good. I think he was on the same label as Al Green. And so obviously, you know, everyone was in Al Green's shadow for a while there. But it turns out that later on, like decades later, he became one of the most sampled artists in all of hip-hop. And so I think the doc goes into whether or not he's collecting royalty checks for that, and, you know, maybe he's trying to capitalize on his popularity by way of hip-hop. And to me, it sounds really fascinating, not just as a story of a musician that we should know about but don't, but also how that musician has kind of gotten a second chance. And it really reminds me of it makes me think of two docs, one being Charles Bradley, Something in America. But anyway, it's a documentary about Charles Bradley, soul singer, who didn't really put out his first album until he was in his 60s, because he was a James Brown impersonator his whole life. So he kind of got a second chance that way. And then one of my favorite docs that I've seen in a long time is called Searching for Sugar Man. I don't know if
you've
heard of that one.
Yeah, I have.
Yeah, and so that's the story of a folk singer named Rodriguez who, kind of like Phil Johnson, was great but didn't really get the publicity he deserved. And then, unbeknownst to him, he was as popular as Elvis in South Africa. So it's about him going to South Africa for the very first time and selling out stadiums, which is crazy to me. So sounds like it's along those lines, and I can't wait to see it.
Cool. My number one is a feature-length documentary called Keddy. It is directed by Ceyda Torun, and it's a Turkish movie, and it's a feature-length documentary about the cats of Istanbul. Apparently, like, Istanbul is overrun by cats.
that does sound interesting, yeah.
This is something that Kyle Sullivan, I think a fellow Birmingham film nerd, posted a trailer to this and said he had seen it at Sidewalk, and I watched the trailer, and it looks fascinating. First of all, the cinematography looks beautiful, and it's you're just following around cats in this incredibly bustling and gorgeous city, and it just seems like a entirely fascinating perspective that you wouldn't get, you just wouldn't get anywhere else. So I want to see it just because of the to get a feature length documentary out of that concept is there's got to be something going on there, and I feel like it's a story that I want to hear. And just doing a little bit more research on the film, the filmmaker seems to have a very interesting background, and so I'm kind of interested to see what she brings to it personally. As somebody that grew up in the city and kind of counts herself as one of the cats in a way. Like, she kind of grew up in the streets. So, it's called Keddy. It's like capital K-E-D and then lowercase I. And if nothing else, just go watch the trailer and just be delighted.
Yeah, I saw a Turkish movie this year, but I think it was the polar opposite of that one. It was a horror. Well, maybe not directly, but it's a horror movie called Baskin. It's real weird, real gross and bloody, and of course I loved it.
Yeah,
shout out to Turkey.
unless you're like a mouse, I don't think that this is technically a horror movie.
Wow.
But yeah, hey man, Turkey is they've got some good movies. They have They had Once Upon a Time in Anatolia a few years ago, so they're riding high. But
yeah, good year for Turkey.
Absolutely, Jeremy. Thank you for your time, and everybody.
I got to get my number one in there.
Oh, good Lord! I'm sorry. All right, hold, let me back up, and I'll edit that
sure,
out.
Sure, sure.
Okay, so Jeremy, what is your number one?
My number one is, it's called Tower, and this was really high on my list for the weekend, but unfortunately, it was at the exact same time as Little Sister on Sunday night. And, you know, in hindsight, I made the right choice by going to Little Sister because I absolutely loved it. But Tower is a documentary on the mass shooting at the University of Texas. I believe that was just commemorating 50th anniversary this month. But what's fascinating to me, not only the story of that, which I know a little bit about, but not a ton, is the way they filmed it. They did it in that rotoscope animation.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
Kind of like what Linklater did with Waking
mm-hmm.
Life and Scanner Darkly.
Yep.
And so just the fact, like, an animated documentary to me sounds so fascinating. And, like I mentioned, Montage of Heck, the Kurt Cobain doc from last year. They had some animation in there, too, which was really interesting. So this sounds kind of like a totally different thing. And I think they took actual archival footage and then animated that with the rotoscope. So it sounds really fascinating, both in terms of story and form. So that's why that one's really high on my list.
Awesome. Yeah, I have not heard of that, so I'll have to check it out. I think everybody should definitely check out your piece on AL.com where you kind of break down the films that you, the 10 films that you saw. It's really helpful. And I think all of these movies, I don't think we've really talked about one that we don't at least recommend that everybody go research and put on your watch list on Letterboxd and check out.
Yeah, there was, like I said, I saw 10 films, 10 feature films over the weekend. There was one that I was lukewarm on, but I erred on the positive side, and one that I didn't like. So that's like a 8.5 out of 10 that I really enjoyed. And that's a great percentage, you know, for fitting 10 films in the one weekend.
Yeah, absolutely. And I look forward to next year. Hopefully I'll have some more time. This year, like I said, I didn't get to spend too much of my time watching movies. I spent most of my time with you and friend Joey Brown on the dance floor screaming Boyhood at Ella Coltrane.
Yes, the star of Boyhood, who celebrated a birthday at our very own Sidewalk Film Festival. So,
that's right.
Since we know
Special
you're listening, Eller, happy birthday.
Yeah, we're sorry if you overheard us screaming Boyhood at you.
We actually really love your movie, so.
Of course we do.
Yeah.
But yes, so thanks for your time, Jeremy, and have
of course.
A great day.
Hey, you too, man. Good talk.
For more Film Nerds Unlimited, go to filmnerds.com. Or find us on Facebook and Twitter. If you like what you hear, rate and review our podcast on iTunes. Keep an eye out for the next issue of Film Nerds Unlimited, coming soon.